You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different. With the ESO Network Patreon, the cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With four tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at patreon.com/ESO Network.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 235 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Sensational Wonder Woman number 14, Far Sector number 11, Batman 107, Crime Syndicate number 2, Green Lantern number 1, The Swamp Thing number 2, Supergirl season 6 episode 2, A Few Good Women, Flash season 7 episode 6, The One with the 90s, and Zack Snyder's Justice League. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, first up for DC News, and the only thing I have for this week, Black Lightning's back this week after being on hiatus for a few weeks, so that's cool. I think the episode actually airs tonight, so excited for that to be back.
Yeah, and I think we're getting in the home stretch for that show too, right?
Yep, that's all I got for DC News, so let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk our comics talk.
Look, we gotta talk.
Yeah, Thunder Talk.
We're going all kinds of sideways with that sweet nerd junk.
Woke nerd junk.
It's topical.
Political.
Dare I say radical.
We've got all your latest news and reviews.
Hot music.
And a whole lot of comedy.
But it ain't for kids.
Definitely mature content.
So let's talk.
Let's talk Thunder Talk.
Thunder Talk is a proud member of the ESO Network.
And we're back! But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know, there's gotta be spoilers.
We got spoilers! 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 We got spoilers! Spoilers! For you! We got spoilers! 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 We've got spoilers! Spoilers! For you! For you!
All right, let's talk Sensational Wonder Woman number 14. It's been 48 hours since Natalia Close and her son Theo went missing. Wonder Woman goes to Mr. Christian Matheson's apartment. Wonder Woman discovers that Natalia came through the apartment with a baseball bat, destroying thousands of dollars worth of equipment. Wonder Woman goes to Natalia's childhood home to find the fire department there trying to put out a fire. Wonder Woman rushes inside and finds Natalia's mother. Wonder Woman realizes that Natalia is seeking to punish all those who have wronged her. At his office, Brutus Close discovers that Natalia withdrew $10 million from multiple accounts after her disappearance. Natalia shows up at Brutus's office with a private security force. Natalia tries to gas her husband with a pesticide his company produces. Wonder Woman shows up in time to save him. Wonder Woman is able to convince Natalia to leave Theo behind. And Natalia states that Nina, which is her nickname, doesn't exist anymore. There's only the mask. And Natalia puts on the mask and escapes by helicopter. For the last two pages, looks like there's been a time jump. Brutus is with Theo at the park, and it's snowing. Wonder Woman has stopped by to check on both. And the comic doesn't come out and say it, but it sounds like Natalia is still on the run somewhere. Which was kind of surprising because it would feel like to me Wonder Woman would go after Natalia. And I would have thought that she would have tracked her down and got her some professional help, but that's not what happened here.
I thought this was an odd ending because it ended, right? The story clearly was not over. I'm assuming they're going to circle back to this one at some point.
That's the feeling I got too.
Right? It might not be the next issue, but I wonder if maybe we'll get another two-parter, down the road. Maybe a couple other writers come on and then they circle back to this one because, it's not done. It so clearly isn't done. The Natalia's story's not very well wrapped up. They get into, more in depth what we saw last issue as to why this would happen, right? But we kind of got a lot of the why last time, and this was kind of seeing more of the fallout from that, which was good. But we didn't get into it all. The villain that kind of pushes her into this, we didn't get any reference to that this issue, and then we didn't really get any closure, right? Because like you said, Wonder Woman. I think it's implied that Wonder Woman's still going to go after her. She just hasn't done it yet. And it's just kind of, it's odd that it ends there. So I hope and I assume that they're going to circle back at some point. Because I'm interested. It was pretty good. I would like to read more of it.
Yeah, me too. But right now, when I looked at the comics for next week, there is not Sensational Wonder Woman on there. So that that worries me a little bit. We were going week to week here. It's possible they're taking a break or something, and I just don't realize it, but it's not on the schedule for next week, I can tell you that, so I hope it's on there the week after. And if they're taking a small break, I wish they'd tell us.
Right.
This series has been so good, I don't want it to end yet.
Especially because a series like this feels like it's... Honestly, I wouldn't be upset if the mainline Wonder Woman title was like this. I know there's a lot to be said for a serialized ongoing story because you get invested in it, but there are some benefits to doing it this way too. It all depends obviously on the quality, but one nice thing with these, like we mentioned last time, is if one of the stories is a clunker, you're not locked into it for very long.
No, you're not. And the series, well, it comes out weekly, so it moves pretty quick. And it's very possible, being a weekly series, that they are taking a break from it. But I wish we got some news about that. Just a tad worried, that's all.
I wonder if they're just, because it's a digital only, that they just don't think to make announcements for that the same way they would for print, because you don't have anybody, picking up their pull box or anything.
That's true, but it'd still be nice to know.
Oh, I agree. I agree completely.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Bar Sector number 11. Before we get into the recap of this issue, I want to talk about the first page of this issue, which is an Owen intelligence file that is for Guardian Eyes only, and it's redacted. It says, on the eve of their decision regarding City Enduring's request for a Green Lantern, the Guardians discover that a Green Lantern is already on the scene, one who isn't on the assignment rolls, one whose ring is non-standard. The Guardian who sent Joe to City Enduring stated that every simulation suggests that the City Enduring would transform into an aggressor empire, threatening the peace on a galactic scale. I found that interesting that they put that at the beginning there.
Yeah, I did too. I liked it because it was one of the kind of rare moments we've had where we kind of step out from the world that the whole story's taking place in and kind of see a little bit of the perspective looking in on what's going on.
Yeah. When the issue opens up, we see that citizens are having problems trying to vote. On top of that, all citizens are being advised to retreat to designated bombardment shelters. We see that Gloria has taken control of the military, and she has ordered the ship captains to bombard the city platforms. Gloria has ground troops trying to get to the platform screen generators. Lumer attacks with anti-bombs, and some citizens would rather die than live on in this emotional hell. There is also a civil war going on with the Atville. And we find out that the money Marth made from Switch Off was funding Cloud Cryptocracy, old enemies to counter Glory's plan. With only 20% power left, Joe goes to fight the battle fleet. We made it. There's only one issue left of this.
I'm excited to see how it ends. I'm curious your thoughts on this, Drew. I don't know if maybe it was just been a little bit too long since I read the last issue, but it almost felt like too much was going on for me in this issue a couple times. It just felt like there was like, oh, this is going on. And then also the at people are at war with themselves in the digital world. And it was like, oh, okay. I get it. It's not that it didn't make sense, but it just seemed like a lot. Like, I think that to me, at least, it felt like it was throwing a lot at me all at once.
I totally agree with you, because when I was trying to summarize my notes for this, there was a lot going on, and I was having problems trying to condense it all down.
That being said, I still enjoyed the issue. It was odd. This was kind of the first one where I felt like it bit off a little too much. I felt like the pacing of this comic overall has been very good. But this one just, and again, I have to attribute at least part of it to the amount of time since I read the last issue, but we've had that gap before, and it didn't, I don't know, for whatever reason, this one just, I was like, wow, there's a lot going on. There's like three or four different conflicts going on, and I was just having a hard time keeping track and in a sense, like mentally prioritizing them, like which one's the one that's the most important, which one's the one I need to care about the most. I don't know. And I mean, not necessarily supposed to be asking that question, but that was sort of inevitably what I felt.
Yeah. And part of the reason probably is, I mean, there's a lot of chaos going on right now and a lot of things happening, and we're coming to the end. So I'm excited for the wrap up of this, because we know Joe's coming into the regular Green Lantern series, so I'm excited about that.
Agreed.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Batman 107. Now, last issue, I was confused by the Scarecrow being in Mayor Nakano's home, and I thought the mayor had a Scarecrow costume. But in reality, Scarecrow was just there leaving the mayor a message, a threat against the people of Gotham. Now, Batman has an encounter with Rene Montoya, who we find out is the new commissioner of police. Apparently, Rene is old friends with Mayor Nakano, and she was uncharacteristically anti-Batman in this scene. I've always seen Rene pro-Batman, while Bullock was always, you know, against Batman. So this scene kind of felt a little weird to me. Now, Harley Quinn is calling herself Batman's new official sidekick, and we see she stops an escaped Arkham inmate who is calling himself Stabbo. Apparently, Stabbo is off his meds and is trying to stab people with his knife because he needs them safely back in the dirt. Now, when Harley Quinn is confronted by a police officer, she whacks him with her baseball bat. And Harley Quinn kind of felt unnecessary in the story to me. Now, Batman visits Oracle in the clock tower. She tells Batman her plan to put bat signals around the city and to give people hope and to have a way to contact Batman when he goes radio silent. She also suggests Batman go undercover to find out what the Insanity Collective is up to. Their leader, Master Wise, has some machine called a mind machine that erases people's memories. We find out that Mr. Simon, the guy behind the magistrate, is working with the Scarecrow. And then, of course, at the end of the issue, we see Batman goes undercover as Matches Malone to infiltrate the Insanity Collective.
Drew, I have to say one thing with this comic that I think is an interesting thing for the writer to do, but I don't know that it's really paid off yet, is the framing device of the Scarecrow having already captured Bruce. But we're getting up to that point. I just feel like he's not done enough to remind us of that. So, like, I feel like, so we've seen it, I think it was at the end of last issue, and then we saw it again at the beginning of this issue, that the Scarecrow has captured him, and the other events we're seeing are kind of all taking place before that.
That was at the
beginning.
It was at the beginning of last issue too. Okay. Because it really annoyed me. It annoyed me even more this issue, because I don't like when they jump into stuff like that and then do the the flashback kind of thing. I'd rather just start the story and get up to that point. That annoys me a lot with comics.
I don't necessarily, you know, the Flash, we've talked about this many times, the Flash is incredibly guilty of that. They love that trope. I don't necessarily mind it if you do it the right way, but I feel like in this case, he's not done enough with it. Like, he jumped, that whatever is going on with him and the Scarecrow is so far in advance that I forget that that's a status quo. Like, I'm reading the rest of the story, and so much is happening time-wise that it's like, oh, wait, yeah, at some point he gets captured by the Scarecrow, but it doesn't seem particularly soon. It feels like we're getting almost an entire story, and then he gets captured by the Scarecrow, in which case that framing device just doesn't make sense because they're not close enough to matter, at least I don't think.
Yeah, it does seem like it's far off. I mean, we've had two issues already, and he still hasn't been captured yet.
I don't think he'll get captured next issue either. I mean, then certainly I could be wrong about that, but pacing-wise, it doesn't feel that way. And like you said, like if it's this far off, why? Why even do that? Why not just tell the story straight up and just get to it?
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
I think it would be a better surprise. Honestly, Drew, I think I'd be more surprised if the Scarecrow actually captures Batman. Because if I was ignoring that part and I was reading everything else, I wouldn't expect that to happen. I wouldn't necessarily be shocked, but it would have at least some surprise to it. Be like, oh, okay, I wasn't expecting that.
You know, if they would have just left the Scarecrow out of the story so far and him just show up when he captures Batman, it would be a surprise. Because you wouldn't expect it with this story it being about the Scarecrow.
Well, and what I think is interesting here is I think they could have left all the Scarecrow stuff in if we hadn't actually seen, if they take out the scenes that we actually see him in, like the framing device, and then I think there's like one or two other scenes where he's talking to the guy that'll do the police force. But if we don't actually see him, but we see all the other stuff that it appears to be, what's interesting is in the main part of the story, they're not entirely sure that it is Scarecrow. Like, they're pretty sure it is, but he was initially thought maybe he was dead. We learned this issue that he wasn't, that was a fake body. But then, like, there's other stuff, and they're sort of now questioning, like, is he the one responsible for the Joker attack? I think there could be a lot more mystery to it where is it the Scarecrow? Is it really the Scarecrow? Is it somebody else impersonating him? Is it somebody else that was impersonating the Joker attack? Like, all of that, I think there could be a little more mystery instead of just giving it all away with the framing device.
Now, did you find it weird that Renee Montoya was kind of antagonistic towards Batman?
I guess. I don't know. I feel like with any of the GCPD cops, I think you can play them either way. Like, I've seen Bullock be both. You know what I mean? Like,
that's true. I have seen them both. I've seen them more often as antagonistic towards Batman. But I have seen them both ways, too.
Yeah, I agree that normally she would be an ally, but it didn't really throw me because it's just there are so many Batman stories that involve him being, you know, at odds with the police force, and maybe it's Jim Gordon one time, or maybe it's Bullock, or maybe it's, in this case, it's her. I don't know. I agree with you that it's unusual, but I guess I didn't really give it as much thought just because it didn't seem that out of the norm for one of those characters to do that.
I also felt that the Harley Quinn part of the story didn't need to be in this issue.
Yeah, but I also think that I think she's going to be important coming up in some story. I don't know necessarily that it's this one, but I have a feeling that they're wanting to use her again, and so it's better to keep her kind of like in the periphery.
That's true. I mean, that would probably be better than just her just showing up at some point.
Right, exactly. So I could be wrong about that, but I have the sense that, I mean, clearly he views her as a main character in his plot right now. not amazing, again, not necessarily this story, but in his Batman saga overall. So it just makes sense to me to at least keep the character in the periphery. Almost like, you know what I mean? Like Alfred just always would pop up, you know, from time to time, just be like, hey, FYI, he's around.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's kind of what it felt like
to me. That makes sense. And honestly, Batman doesn't really have anybody on his side right now, does he? I mean, he has Oracle, but without an Alfred, you need somebody to take that spot. So.
Yeah. Well, right. And we know Catwoman is absent, too. So.
Yeah.
He's got a little bit more of a void in terms of allies in Gotham than he had previously had shortly ago.
Yep. All right. We had a backup story in this, a Ghostmaker one. And in this backup story, Ghostmaker is on his way to Devil Skull Island to take down a mysterious villain named Madame Midas, whose family has been doing criminal business for centuries. She's gathered unheard-of assassins to take him out. Now, when Ghostmaker lands on the island, he's attacked by tiger robots with laser eyes. And it's to be continued. Ghostmaker feels kind of like Punchline to me. Tinian is trying really hard to make us like Ghostmaker. And I don't know. Ghostmaker doesn't feel like he fits in with the Batman mythos to me. We don't really need another anti-hero. We already have the Red Hood, who honestly has a better connection with Batman than Ghostmaker. So I don't know why he's pushing this Ghostmaker so hard.
I think he kind of feels a little bit like Clutter, if that makes sense. He does a lot of the same things that a lot of other Batman characters do, right? It's just like I feel like you could use someone else, or you. I mean, he's fine. I don't dislike him, but I also don't. I don't know that he brings a whole. He's basically just like Batman. He's basically Batman. Again, I mean, not that the other characters aren't that, but there's at least more of a story established with them. He's fine. I thought his backup story felt out of tune with what we've gotten of that. His introductory story, he was so grimdark, right? Like, he was so like, oh, every criminal has to die. Bad guys must be killed. Blood, blood. And this felt very, like, not serious. Like, the rogues gallery that we saw in this was a little ridiculous, which was fine. It just felt a little more tongue-in-cheek, but he hasn't felt like that kind of character. So it just, like, tonally felt off to me.
I agree with that assessment, because he did feel a little different from when we were first introduced to him. He felt more happy-go-lucky.
Yeah, that was the thing. He felt like a pretty, like, he felt like a hip, like, newer version of Batman. Is that, you know what I mean? Like a... It was just like, oh, but what if Bruce liked being Bruce Wayne and being the rich young guy? And that's what it felt like. It felt like, you know what I mean, like just a younger, enjoying his wealth version of Batman. Which, again, characterly is, that's fine. I'm not opposed to that character, but that was not the character that was presented to us when he was introduced.
That's very true. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Crime Syndicate Number 2. Donna Troy and President Oliver Queen are fighting off Starros when Ultraman shows up and demands Donna Troy come with him. Owlman is able to capture a Starro specimen and bring it back to the Owl's Nest. Owlman discovers that Starro is recruiting metahumans. Johnny Quick shows up to help Ultraman subdue Donna Troy. He tells her to surrender or die. John Stewart shows up and is able to free Ultraman and some of the others from Starro's control. Next, we see Owlman has hacked his power ring and is downloading info. Suddenly, more Starro metas attack John Stewart. At the end of the story, Owlman shows up and states he's the man with the plan.
And then we also get the backup story. I honestly found the backup story much more entertaining than the main story for this.
I did too. I mean, it was very interesting. Harvey Bullock was murdered by the Waynes. Owlman's mother and father, plus his brother Bruce, all die. And we see that Harvey explains to Owlman that the death of the Waynes was payback from Boss Gordon for killing his son Jimmy Jr. And we see that the Waynes tried to take over Gotham. At least Bullock tells us that the Waynes tried to take over Gotham from Boss Gordon. And Owlman wonders if his parents were criminals. All very interesting. And then, of course, we get the last scene there where Harvey reminds Owlman that he has a code and he doesn't kill. And Owlman says, it doesn't matter. And he drops Harvey off the roof. Very, very interesting. Had you ever seen any of this kind of thing about Owlman before, or is this all new?
I've seen similar. He's had a couple different origins in the past. It was, I mean, hitting familiar beats, but it was a good story. I had not seen this exact version before. It's kind of a little bit different thing that made him crack this time. What I thought was interesting in this one is other versions of Owlman tend to be he's twisted already as a kid, and this one was we see the moment that he kind of cracks with Bullock there. So I liked that twist on the story. It was good. The main story, I have a lot of the same thoughts I had for the first issue. It's not bad. It's just not what I was hoping for from the series. It's clearly they're doing the Justice League fight Starro for the first time, but it's the crime syndicate, and that's just not that clever to me. And nothing in the story's doing really feels that, like, it's not interesting enough that I'm like, ooh, that's kind of, what are you doing there? I'm just sort of like, yeah, okay, but they're bad. I get it. Woo.
I know, it's not that intriguing because we've seen a lot of these beats before, but it's okay. I'm liking it.
Well, that's it. I agree with it. It is a perfectly fine comic. I was not, you know, miserable reading it. I didn't not enjoy it. It was fine. But if I'm going to be recommending comics, I'm not going to recommend one that was serviceable. It's just not doing, like, to take that next step, I think it still has time to do something unexpected and something interesting. It just hasn't, so far through two issues, it hasn't done it yet.
Yeah, and my gut tells me it probably won't. But I agree with you. I like that. I like the backup Owlman story a lot, and I hope we get more of his backstory, though I don't know if we will or not.
They seem to write Owlman a little bit better than the other characters. It feels a little bit like they really just want to write an Owlman book, which I don't blame them, but I wish they would have just gotten that instead of trying to do this whole crime syndicate when they clearly don't have much interest in most of those characters. So, I don't
know. Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Green Lantern number 1. Oa is hosting the United Planets Conclave. Hal Jordan and John Stewart meet Amira Kahlon, captain of the United Planets Brigade. She is Thanagarian and does not like Green Lanterns. Now, the Guardians require an update on the Crux worlds, and Hal Jordan is on Earth and has the Justice League on high alert. Lantern Cruz is in Sector 0123, patrolling Oishia's moons, and Lantern Kyle Rayner is handling a border conflict in the Vegas system. Now, the Guardians call John Stewart for help. Apparently, they have been evaluating and testing Teen Lantern's gauntlet, and we see that the Guardians have done an IQ test, some psych stuff, physical exam, but we see that Killa gets pissed off when the Guardians try to pull off her gauntlet. And John had already warned them not to do that. Now, John has Simon Baz take Kelly to the festival for a break while John discusses Kelly with the Guardians. The Guardians confirm that the gauntlet is not Corona's. They share design elements, but Corona's gauntlet is still in the vault. And they also discover that the gauntlet is not of Owen design and does not draw power from the central battery. We see a group of fairy-like creatures show up. Their leader, Eurydion, calls Kelly a falsie and denies that she's ever been to Gemworld. Kelly gets angry with Eurydion and called her a liar. We learn that Eurydion is from a sorcerer's world named Xerox. She states she's a master opener of doors and gates. Eurydion claims the Guardians broke the cosmos when they stole half its magic heart, and they will pay tonight. Eurydion releases Atmaterium, that starts feeding on everything. We see some stranger comes up to John Stewart and states that he's read the Book of Oa and tells John that this creature eats chaos. Any energy, any action, any emotion. And John has the lanterns power down and still their minds. John tells Eurydion that this is an interesting weapon. The only way to beat it is to not fight it. Eurydion and her people are arrested and taken to the science cells. We find out that Oa is accepted into the United Planets, and a group of people attack the Conclave saying, "Free the heart," and we see that the male guardian is killed.
Okay, Drew, one thing I was a little unclear on, and I'm hoping that you had a better understanding of this. This also does the flash forward thing that you hate. Did the fight that we see, is that the fight that's at the beginning? Because they're talking about a green glow, but then the fight that we see in the second half of the comic is not green.
Yes, it's the same fight. If you notice, see, I hated that in the beginning of this one, too. And if you notice, I just skipped it and started with the story.
I thought this one was not good from the perspective. It wasn't clear that we had actually cycled back to that. There wasn't usually they do some sort of scene that's the same scene to be like, hey, FYI, we've caught back up. And they didn't really do that. And I was pretty sure that we had caught back up, but I wasn't entirely sure. So I was like, because it made it seem like it had gone a little bit worse in the flash forward than when we actually saw the fight break out. It wasn't, I didn't think, as bad as what it portrayed it at the beginning.
Now, the reason why I knew it was the same is because John Stewart says the exact same thing at the beginning that he does on that page when it starts.
Gotcha. In the prison. Okay, that's a good catch. I didn't catch that.
So that's how I knew it was exactly the same. There was a lot going on in this, but I was very happy that we have the Green Lanterns accepted into the United Planets, first of all, and that they're not going away or they're not going powerless, at least not yet. Because I really don't want to see that story, but I'm very interested in why Kelly has this gauntlet, because there's obviously some sort of plan going on, and I'm curious to see it unfold.
There were things that I really liked about this. This felt closer to the Johns era in that it felt more of a galactic soap opera than it has in recent times, excluding the Morrison thing, because that's its own thing. I really like that Sinestro is in charge of his own planet, New Korrigar. I can't remember if that was established in the Sinestro run. I don't think it was, but I might be misremembering. But that was cool. I did feel like it focused on the wrong things, if that makes sense. This isn't the first thing I've read that does that, where they have this really interesting thing or interesting status quo, and they kind of put it in the background, and they focus on something else that's frankly not as interesting. It's like the vote for Oa to join the United Planets is fine. I think that's a cool status quo, but I'm also not that interested in the vote being the main story. I'm a lot more interested in what the heck is Sinestro up to on his planet? That's really interesting. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I was very happy to see Sinestro and the Yellow Lanterns, because that just means they're going to be part of the story in the future. So I'm excited about that.
So. The other thing that I like the character of Teen Lantern. I was not crazy about how they characterized her in this issue. Her only character trait seemed to be fighting people unnecessarily. We've read other comics where she has more personality than that, and she's got interesting things about her. She's in the Mogo story that we read. We see that she, is worthy of being a Green Lantern. But this one was just she just was fighting. Anybody said anything to her, she just started swearing at them in Spanish and tried to fight them. It was one time is funny, but after the sixth time, I'm not amused. Do something else with the character.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I think we will see that. It definitely wasn't in this issue. I have a question for you. Is there only two Guardians left?
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Because they only showed those two Guardians, and we know one of them gets killed at the end of the issue. So now are we down to one Guardian? I'm curious to see if there's more Guardians or what's going on with that. I'm just more excited to see some more of this series. You're right. It felt more Geoff Johns-like, and I really like that. And I want to get more into the story.
Yes. By the end, like I said, the United Planets vote is fine, especially for just introducing the role, introducing what's kind of going on, the status quo. It's fine. But like the end of the issue where a Guardian is assassinated and Sinestro's there, the Red Lanterns are there, there are other people that are clearly maybe not huge fans of the Guardians. That all felt really interesting, and I'm very curious to see where that story goes. And I'm hopeful that it feels, again, it is that they don't need to literally do exactly what Geoff Johns did, because I want them to do their own thing. But like, I would love to make it feel like that world again, getting back to that version of the Lanterns. For, I think, not just us, but for a lot of people, that's their favorite version of the Green Lantern. So I'd love to see a return to that style, seeing all of the Lantern Corps back and doing stuff. Again, tell your own stories. Don't just try and do Geoff Johns, but that world would be nice.
One thing I found odd was that Oa had to apply for membership into United Planets. I would figure the Guardians would be one of the founding members of it, especially with Superman kind of starting it. I just found that odd, but
I think it kind of makes sense when you think about it, though, because in a way, Oa is like a planet version of something like Vatican City, right? Where it's its own planet, but like most of the people that live on that planet aren't really Owen. I don't know. It made sense to me in a way, because it's almost like an intergalactic city in a way.
That's true. That's very true. Anyways, I'm just more excited to see more of the series. So, all right, well, let's move on to our last title for this week, The Swamp Thing number 2. First thing I want to tell you, Cletus, is I didn't realize this was a miniseries. When I started reading this one, I noticed they had a limited number of issues. I'm like, oh, this is only a miniseries. So, but
I don't remember that being on the first issue either, because I noticed the same thing you did, and I don't know if maybe we just missed it, which is entirely possible, to be clear, or if that changed, or if they just like didn't spell that out.
I'm not sure either, but I was surprised when I saw it was a miniseries. Not that that's a big deal. This has been really good so far.
So good. Really, really good.
Now, the issue opens up with Levi coming out of the tree at 3:41 a.m. in Central Park, New York. Jennifer is upset because she's been looking all over for Levi. Levi tells her about his nightmare in the desert and the pale wanderer, and she has a hard time believing it. Now, Levi keeps getting pulled into the desert each night, and the pale wanderer shows up each night, and there's new victims. We see that Jennifer begins to investigate Levi. She wants to run some tests on him at her lab. She's also interested in the blackouts and the transformations. We see that the sheriff from issue 1 returns to the desert to hunt the pale wanderer. The pale wanderer goes to kill the sheriff when Swamp Thing shows up. Now, the pale wanderer and Swamp Thing battle until Swamp Thing turns the pale wanderer into this large tree in the middle of the desert. We see that this tree gets the attention of the media and also the attention of Batman. And I was very curious when we got that panel, because I'm like, are they bringing Batman into the story, or is this the only time we're going to see him?
Nah, I don't think so. I think we're going to see him again.
And that's the kind of indication I got, but I wasn't for sure. Now, the issue ends at Prescott Industries in New York. Mr. Pilgrim has requested file and surveillance, and we see a picture of Levi and Jennifer, and on the file it states the Holland phenomenon, which I'm guessing refers to Alec Holland, and somehow Alec is going to get tied into this version of the Swamp Thing, I'm guessing. I don't know, it's all very intriguing.
It is very good. I highly recommend people check this series out. It's phenomenal. Well, I'm bummed in a way that it's a mini series because it's been so good. I also kind of like that because I feel more confident that we're going to have a really satisfying arc, right? Because you know it's 10 issues. The writer is planning for that. He's going to have a clear 10 issues. This is my story. And as we've seen recently, we tend to get much better stories when that's the case.
I agree with you. And it's always possible they can do another miniseries in the future. So just like we've seen with the White Knight, that kind of method works when you have these short story arcs where you can really focus on the story. If you want to do a sequel, you can come out with another miniseries. So kind of like that format.
I was surprised that the desert villain was taken down in the second issue, but it just worked so well. I mean, this was just really good stuff. The artwork, I think, is really well suited to the type of story that they're telling. I liked Swamp Thing kind of coming to their, you know, realization of what he is and the giant tree growing up out of that. It was good stuff, man. This was just really good book.
Totally agree. All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk our CW shows.
We're the Con Guys, as in Comic-Con, and this is the Con Guys Show, coming at you straight from the heart of Hollywood, California, with the news, celebrity interviews, and fun-loving opinions to help fuel your passions. We are your ultimate insiders, filmmakers, writers, actors, costumers, gamers, panelists, but most of all, we are fans. And whether it's sci-fi, collectibles, comic books, gaming, animation, cosplay, or fan conventions, if you love it, we cover it. Your behind-the-scenes look at all things con.
And we're back. Let's talk Supergirl, Season 6, Episode 2, A Few Good Women. Team Supergirl tracks down a vampire and recruits him to help them find Kara. The vampire has broken into the Phantom Zone before to rescue his husband. Kara discovers her Kryptonian father survived and has been trapped in the Phantom Zone. Lex Luthor has a plan for staying out of prison. In court, Lex is able to discredit Ms. Tessmacher's testimony by showing the jury she was seeking revenge for rejecting her love. The vampire is able to create a portal to the Phantom Zone. Team Supergirl discovers that Crisis has changed the Phantom Zone. It is now a bunch of pocket dimensions, each with its own unique vibrational frequency. We see that three Phantoms come through the portal and attack Team Supergirl. The team is able to hold them off and send them back through the portal. When Eve's testimony fails against Lex, Lena takes the stand. Lex and Lena get into a shouting match, and Lex gives a big speech about power. When the jury returns their verdict, Lex is found not guilty. The vampire Silas discovers that one of the Phantoms was hiding inside of him. In the Phantom Zone, Kara and her father watch as two Phantoms use a portal, something Kara's father has never seen before, and Kara states that they're going to have to catch a Phantom.
Drew, the vampire thing at the beginning of the show was so stupid. I just was baffled as to why they chose that. He could have been anything. Anything. Why? It's just some of these decisions are just they're like unforced errors. It didn't need to be that. They just intentionally chose like the dumbest thing they could think of.
I have no idea why they had a vampire in this.
There was just no purpose. There was no real reason other than they just decided the defining characteristic of this alien was that he was a vampire from an alien world called Transylvania, and that's what caused the vampire. I was just like, that's just all so stupid that you could have done anything. Oh, Drew, they could have done anything, and they landed on that. Blah. I know it's not that big of a deal, but it just sort of highlights my whole issue with a lot of these CW shows, where it's just like, a lot of this just feels very avoidable. It's one thing when you don't have the budget to do certain things, or you don't have the time to film things in a certain way, but like, something like this is so easy to not do, and they just, there it is. Alien vampire.
I was wondering why they needed to seek out a vampire in the first place, because they've got the Phantom Zone projector. don't we have people smart enough, Brainiac 5, could figure out how to rig a way to get into the Phantom Zone? We have to bring in a vampire dude?
Yeah, I agree. It just seems like there, and this is going back to what I talked about in last week's podcast, where these plots just feel frivolous, where this plot could probably be resolved at any time. If they wanted, Supergirl could have been back by the end of this episode, and I don't think either of us would have thought anything of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I actually expected that. I thought she was going to be back. I was surprised they didn't have her back this episode, because that's what they normally do. I didn't expect them to string out the story longer.
And that's sort of the problem, is that they didn't... That means that there's no real stakes, so there's no real, again, natural storytelling consequences and results. It just feels like the writing team is, this is what they're going to do for X number of episodes until they decide they're done, and now Supergirl can come back. But it all just feels self-imposed. Because like you said, they have Brainiac, who's from the future. He really can't figure out a way to like reverse engineer a Phantom Zone projector. But this other random vampire alien can do something similar to that. You know what I mean? It's all arbitrary. It all is just like whatever. It doesn't feel natural to the plot. It just feels like whatever the show needs to artificially extend its story as long as it needs or wants to.
Yeah, and I thought the idea of them trying to capture a Phantom was stupid too. These Phantoms are supposed to be so powerful. You know, how are they going to... What are they going to have there that they're going to be able to capture one of them?
I also, this seems like not really familiar with the concept of the Phantom Zone being literally a Phantom Zone.
I've never heard of that either, so.
It's kind of, again, it's one of those things where it's kind of dumb. It's like, why are we taking this so literally? I could be wrong, and maybe there are comic instances of literal Phantoms in the Phantom Zone. That's fine. But it just feels like they're getting a little cute. Like, oh, what if the Phantom Zone like had phantoms in it? Whoa. You know, it's just like, why can't it just be the interdimensional prison that it's supposed to be? That's bad enough. As we've seen in the Superman comic, going there is still bad. That's where all of his villains are locked up at. That feels like a threat enough. I don't need this weird ghost thing.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm surprised we haven't come across any villains trying to kill Supergirl yet.
I'm sure that'll be an episode where they like go to the wrong pocket dimension or something like that. Again, it's just all so arbitrary to me. Supergirl will be out when the show decides for her to be out, not when it like naturally happens within the plot. I don't know. It's very frustrating.
One thing I do have to comment on, the costumes have been looking good. So, you know, like Martian Manhunter's costume and stuff. I've been liking the costumes. So they are doing that pretty good.
I agree, with the exception of Alex's costume is trying way too hard.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about her costume.
It's the eyeliner thing. Like, so she just goes and does it has to be like half an hour of eye makeup before she goes out anytime as a superhero. It's possible. I feel like she would have better things to do with her life, like, you know, maybe put a mask on. I don't know.
We're going back to Arrow season one.
Okay, but at least, to be fair, I thought while it was a little bit silly, I thought Arrow at least made it make sense, where he's literally just smearing it on. Right? That takes like 2 seconds. She's got very nice, very well done eye makeup on. I don't know, maybe she's just Martian technologying it on her, like her, whatever, her suit just lets her manifest anything. How come she isn't able to just manifest a magical thing to go into the Phantom Zone?
That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
I mean, I didn't really, in the first episode, there didn't really seem to be any real limitations to her suit. It kind of seemed to be whatever she wanted. So if we're going to go down that road, then why can't she just, like, magic something up? I don't know.
It does feel like Lex is going to be more prevalent in this last season than it felt like in the first episode.
I agree. Well, and I think that's a good thing. I think he should be the villain of the final season, because anything other than that's just going to feel empty, frankly. I have to say, though, I thought his gotcha moment with Tessmacher was not the gotcha that the writers made it, wanted you to think it was. Like, he goes up to the judge at the end and is like, I'd like her testimony stricken from the record and tried for perjury. And I know that it's Lex being Lex, but also, like, he's delivering that with, like, a sense of confidence that that actually is going to happen, which is absurd. Drew, she does nothing in that like, 10-second rant that would implicate her in a crime. And the show is just like, whoa, he totally blew up that entire thing. There's no way he could be found guilty now. I was like, what? Come on.
I know exactly what you mean.
I'm not saying it's not possible. It's certainly possible that that would be enough, but the show was making it seem like he had just slam dunk, no doubt about it, won the trial. And I was like, what? If their entire test trial rested on that, then they're not doing a good enough job in the first place.
I got to tell you, though, I'm loving John Cryer as Lex Luthor. I think he does a great job at it.
Well, he clearly has fun playing the character, and that joy is palpable, right? Like, his scenes are fun because he's clearly having fun. That's not to say necessarily that the other actors aren't, but it just feels, again, because this show, and I don't want to blame the actors necessarily, but because this show just feels so much like actors just saying their lines, when it's not somebody like John Cryer, who is clearly just hamming it up and loving it, it doesn't have the same impact because you're cognizant that you're watching an actor, I feel, more than seeing a character. And when they're doing their job, again, just doing their job, it's just, and you're like, ah, okay, whatever. So I just think he stands out more because of that.
Oh, okay.
That's just my opinion.
All right, well, let's move on to our next episode for this week. Flash, Season 7, Episode 6, The One with the 90s. When the episode opens up, Barry is still in cryogenic freeze, healing. Chester and Cisco come up with an idea for an early warning system for the forces. Chester and Cisco go on a field trip to test the equipment. They get zapped by a wave of energy that sends them back to the year 1998. Both are surprised to see a blockbuster with Space Jam guaranteed in stock. Chester and Cisco go to the local high school searching for the physical form of the Time Force. They find this guy named Parker and start asking him questions when the green energy hits again and the day starts over. Cisco thinks he's 7 years old, and Cisco runs away from Chester yelling, "Stranger danger!" When trying to find parts to fix Chester's device, they come across Chester's dad. Chester's dad is supposed to die the next day, so Chester takes the opportunity to know his dad better. Dion shows up as the Time God. He knows Chester and Cisco should not be there, and he makes their device disappear from time. Next, he sends a wave of temporal energy through the city, and the rest of Team Flash looks like they're living in the 1970s. Chester is able to talk to Dion and convince him not to mess up time, and Dion fixes time and disappears. Cisco comes up with names for the different forces: the Steel Force, the Strength Force, and the Sage Force. The episode ends with Joe telling Frost that someone is hunting her. I know you really like time loop stories, but even though they were kind of advertising this was going to be a time loop story, it only looped once.
This was not a time loop story.
No, it wasn't.
For them to label it as such is ridiculous. You can't call it a time loop if you only loop one time.
Exactly. I was like very disappointed in that.
And they didn't even do any, like, there was nothing about it that was, like, you know, like the kind of hallmarks of a time loop where you do you do at least one thing the same way twice, right? Like, they didn't do any of that. That was disappointing. Drew, I am really not a fan of the Speed Force being manifested as a person. It is bothering me a lot.
And the weird thing about it is, you got Iris hanging out with Nora like they're buddy, but the Speed Force isn't a person.
That's the thing that's annoying me. I know we've seen the Speed Force take the form of Nora before, but it's always been like
I felt it was meant to be like a, this is what Barry is picturing in his mind, right? Is a way to, for us as the show, to make sense of him talking to an intangible thing. But now we've made it tangible. And the thing that's really annoying me is that the show is kind of cross-pollinating with Nora Allen, in that they, some of the characters are straight up referring to her as Nora. It's not Nora, Drew. It's the Speed Force. At one point, Joe is like, hey, good to see you again, Nora. He's never seen her. That's not Nora. He doesn't know her.
To disagree with you there, I thought the Allens and the Wests were friends before Barry's parents were killed.
I agree, but that's not Nora Allen. That's the thing that's annoying. Like he says, hey, good to see you again, Nora, as if that's Nora Allen, but it's not.
Gotcha.
Drew, you're right. To be clear, you're right. He knows Nora Allen, the human Nora Allen. And I know that the Speed Force is taking on her persona, but I feel like the show is like forgetting, or just it's just getting confused, where it's like sometimes it's the Speed Force as Nora Allen, but then also sometimes she is Nora Allen. And it's just like, but no, it's the Speed Force. It's not a person.
They were very much having the Speed Force feel like it was Barry's mom, like Iris is spending time with her mother-in-law.
I agree, and that's the thing that's driving me nuts, because none of this makes sense, because it's not Nora Allen, and it feels like it. If you want Nora Allen to be on the show, just do it. It's the Flash. Have it be another parallel world. I know that they kind of got rid of them, but whatever. Bring it back. Technically it's still out there.
You know what would be more interesting than that? I think more interesting than that would be the Reverse Flash bringing back Nora and messing with Barry. Sure. I think that would be an interesting story. And then have him kill her again. That would be very tragic.
The thing that's, I think, also frustrating to me with this is the other forces. I think they're trying to have it so that each force is represented by a person, but they're not the literal embodiment of those. Like the guy that was the still force in this episode is a real dude, right? It's not the still force embodied as a person. It's a dude. And that's Barry for the Speed Force. He already exists. You know, that's the one thing. The one thing that the comic did is it didn't give us another separate Speed Force person. It just had it did the stupid Force story, and it had different avatars of the Force. Like, so they had somebody who was the Strength Force, someone who was the Sage Force, had that power imbued in them. And Barry was the Speed Force, right?
Right.
And the show seems to like not understand that concept, that it already has that, and instead they're like, well, if we're doing that, we need to have the Speed Force. Well, you do. It's literally the name of your show.
Yeah, they don't get that, do they? We don't need to have the Speed Force as Nora, because Barry's the avatar for the Speed Force. Just like the other forces should have an avatar for them, but what they're doing is they're manifesting these forces physically, like we have the Still Force was that, or the Strength Force was that monster. And we had the, like in this episode, we had that football player, basketball, whatever player that was, he was the Time Force. I don't know, it's just weird.
I know that that's the name of the forces in the comics, but that was such a clear, this is what they're supposed to be called, even though it makes no logical sense to name them this. You know, like the Sage Force one. You literally are only doing that because that's what the name is in the comics. That does not make sense within the context of the show. And the Still Force, I thought, was even more egregious.
Yeah, I agree with you.
What we saw is absolutely not the Still Force. It's time. It is so clearly dealing with time. They're like, it's the opposite of speed. Still.
No, it's not.
Were you guys frozen? You sure didn't look frozen. You look like you were moving around just fine.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
I'm very frustrated because I know I already know that I'm not going to – it's so unlikely that I'm going to like this story because I hated the comic version of this, and I have no faith that the show is going to elevate it into something better, especially not based on what we've seen so far. So it's just frustrating for me because I feel like I'm hostage to the show.
Yeah, I know what you mean. All right, well, let's move on to our last topic for today. Zack Snyder's Justice League. Finally watched it. And I gotta tell you, Cletus, I wasn't as disappointed as I thought I was going to be with it. It felt like a more cohesive story to me because it spent 3/4 of the movie building up the characters.
I think both of us were expecting a more complete version of the story. I know I certainly was. So I've also seen, prior to this, the extended version of Batman vs. Superman. And personally, I don't like that movie that much. But the extended version is objectively better in my mind. It is clearly better than the theatrical version of Batman vs. Superman. Because Lex's plot is, I think, most of what got cut out of the theatrical version, which is a baffling decision. I don't know who ultimately made that choice, whether that was Snyder or whether that was the studio, but that was the wrong thing to cut from that movie because his plot doesn't really make sense, I don't think, in the theatrical version. And it's laid out much more clearly, makes way more sense. Ultimately, the movie still comes down to Batman and Superman realizing their moms are both named Martha. So there are some inherent flaws. But the extended version, the more complete version of Snyder's vision for that was better. So I expected the same thing with this Snyder cut of the Justice League. I was sure that we would get a more coherent version, and we absolutely did. I mean, it is clearly better. If you've not seen Justice League, don't watch the theatrical version. You've got to watch this one instead. It is so clearly better. Clearly better. You might not necessarily like the movie still, but it's better. I mean, it is absolutely the better version of the film.
I was surprised it had more humor in it than I was expecting. I wasn't expecting as much humor as we got in it. And I like the interaction between the characters we got.
I think I agree with that, Drew. I think Zach got a little bit of crap for that was maybe not deserved because a lot of people thought they brought in Jaws to make it funnier. And the guys certainly added more quips and stuff. But if I'm going to be honest with you, a lot of them are worse. Like, some of the moments that he added to be funnier are bad. Like, the Flash falling into Wonder Woman's boobs is terrible. That is such a bad choice. But that's what he brought that, like, ha ha, funny. And that's just bad. And to be fair, there were some legitimately good, funny lines that he added. Like, the Aquaman speech with the lasso I thought was fairly funny. But for the most part, most of his stuff that he added was, frankly, unnecessary. It didn't really make it better.
No, it didn't.
I think the first thing I want to talk about getting into specifics is Steppenwolf. Oh my goodness. It is night and day. First off, I encourage people to look up a side-by-side comparison of the two visually. It's way better. It's way better. And what's surprising to me, Drew, is that I'm pretty sure if Zach had been able to put out the theatrical version of this movie, he still probably would have looked like the one that we saw in the theatrical cut, because that's, from what I read, that's what the studio wanted. It's so much better with this version. I can't believe the studio thought that the what they put out first was the better look.
I have to agree with you there. I like this.
And then more. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I like this version of Steppenwolf a lot better.
More importantly, than the look, I think, is a big improvement. I really liked his look visually. Story-wise, though, a massive, massive improvement. Whoever thought that the theatrical version of Steppenwolf, story-wise, was a better choice than the Steppenwolf that we got in the Snyder Cut needs to never be involved in film again. Because I don't see objectively how there's any argument that the theatrical version of Steppenwolf is better in any capacity, visually or story-wise. I mean, again, you may not necessarily enjoy it, but I still feel like he is objectively better. The fact that he is more clearly working for Darkseid, there's much more of a purpose to what he's doing. There's more of a sense of understanding why he's doing what he's doing. I actually, like, I sympathize, like, when he so desperately wants to get back in Darkseid's good graces, and you feel the desperation of him for him to succeed. Like, obviously I'm not rooting for the guy, but I felt something for the character. I actually cared about what was going on with him. So I thought some of the best stuff we got were the sort of status reports with Desaad. Those were great. I can't. Why on earth would you get rid of those?
I know. It brought a lot more depth to the character.
Way more depth. And not just depth, but like a reason to care at all what he was doing. I mean, he is like the worst version of a superhero villain in the theatrical version, where he's just there to be beaten. Right. Like, I mean, in the theatrical version, technically he's doing the same thing he does in the Snyder cut, but there's not a clear reason for it. He's doing it because he's the bad guy, and that's what the bad guy does.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Just to reiterate, if you've not seen the theatrical one, I would recommend not watching it. And I know the Snyder cut's going to be longer, but if you have any interest in Justice League at all, the Snyder cut for the villain alone is a vast, vast improvement.
I have to say, of course, I didn't sit down and watch the whole 4 hours at once, but when I did sit down and watch parts of it, it seemed to go fast. It didn't seem like it was drawn out. There was a natural flow to the story.
I agree. There were a few things here and there that I thought weren't paced well, but for the most part, my girlfriend and I sat down to watch it, and we were expecting it to feel long, right? Because it's 4 hours. We were expecting it to feel long, and not that it was short. I mean, it's still a 4-hour movie, but we didn't feel it. Like, it felt like the movie's like, oh, okay. I was not tired or like clock watching as the movie went on. Like, it had me interested and it had my attention. So I have to give it a lot of credit there. Now, to be clear, this movie does not need to be 4 hours long. There was definitely stuff that they could have cut, but that's the whole point of the Snyder cut, right? It's the total, complete, full, uncut vision of Snyder. That's 4 hours. The downside of that, I don't know necessarily when I would rewatch this. I liked it. I enjoyed it. But 4 hours is a lot of time commitment. I wish that there was a shorter version of this story.
I know I'm going to watch it again at some time, but I don't think I'll ever sit down and watch all 4 hours at once. It'll be broken up into bits. That 4 hours is a long time for me to have set aside to not have anything else to do.
I would love to see a 3-hour cut of this film. I truly think you could get this, the Snyder version of Justice League. I think you could make it a 3-hour movie pretty easily. You know, obviously if you do like a few quick cuts here and there, like I watched a side-by-side comparison of the Superman versus Justice League fight from both movies. And there's a couple times where, like, frame by frame, they're mostly the same early on. But there's a couple times in the theatrical version where they simply, like, cut a couple frames out where you're effectively getting the same thing, but it's just, like, a little bit shorter in the theatrical version. Like, they could have done that for a couple of the fights where they're not, like, taking out big action, but they're just, like, shortening it just a little bit. And then there's other things, like they linger on a couple shots, like the Kent home. They linger on that for like 30 seconds too long. The song when Aquaman swims away is wildly unnecessary. So like there's stuff to cut there. And again, I know that's not the point of the Snyder cut, so I know why it's included. But I would love to see a 3-hour version of this film, because I'm so sure that you could do it and it would still feel like the same movie.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right on that. Another thing I really enjoyed about this, of course, I only watched the theatrical version once in the theater. But I did enjoy Alfred in this movie. It felt like he was portrayed a lot more and interacted with the different members of the Justice League. I thought he was good to include in this.
Well, he had much more purpose to the story. I mean, you're right. He's not in the theatrical version that much, and he's not in it enough to have mattered. all that much. There were some casting things that I think this movie got a little bit of crap for, where they're like casting these big names and then didn't really use them. But as we saw in the Snyder Cut, they did, like Commissioner Gordon, they did use, I mean, not a ton, but they used him. He wasn't completely absent like he was in the theatrical one where he showed up for like 30 seconds.
Yeah, he had, even though he had a role in this, it was a lot bigger. It was a larger role than we got in the theatrical version, and it made sense.
Agreed. And then going back, circling back to Alfred, much more involved in the plot. What he's doing matters in the plot. Yeah, Jeremy Irons was great. I'm not surprised, obviously, that I enjoyed his increased role. I was thrilled to get it.
He felt much more like Bruce's partner than he did his butler, for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The other big thing that I also wanted to focus on, and this is just my overall take, my biggest takeaway from the Snyder Cut, is I'm just baffled at the studio decisions that went into the theatrical version that we saw. The big one being Steppenwolf is just such a baffling choice on their part. I do not understand. And the second one is Superman. Some of those scenes, even if you prefer, so for using the Superman fight, for example, that scene is mostly the same. The only thing that's really different is his confrontation with Batman. As we see in the Snyder Cut, it's wordless. He just kind of stares at him and then heat visions him a couple times until Lois talks him down. In the theatrical version with Whedon, we get that terrible "do you bleed" line. Even if you prefer that version, I don't, but even if you do, it's not worth the CGI lips. That's the thing that doesn't make sense to me, Drew. One of my big takeaways from Superman from this movie is, what were they thinking refilming his stuff? Even if you think they are slight improvements, it's not worth the CGI lips. I just don't understand. If you could have done it and Henry Cavill doesn't have the mustache and you can just film it normally, sure. Again, to be clear, I preferred what we got with Snyder, but even if you liked a little bit better the stuff you got from Whedon, it's not better enough to have been worth the terrible, terrible CGI lips.
Agreed. Yeah, the Snyder version was much more enjoyable, I thought.
The one pacing thing that I will say that I think I don't want to say that necessarily that the Whedon film did well, but I think did a little bit better than the Snyder version was the lead up to Superman's resurrection. It's very fast in the Snyder Cut, which is weird for a 4-hour movie, but they move very quickly on that. It's basically the instant they realize that they can resurrect him, they do it. I felt like there was less build up for that. I don't know what you thought there.
That didn't bother me that much. I didn't think we needed to drag it out that much. I mean,
I didn't necessarily need it dragged out as much as it, pacing wise, compared to the rest of the movie, that one, it felt quick. It felt really quick. Like there, we get like almost an hour and a half into the film and they realize what the mother box can do. And so then they bring him back almost immediately. And then the rest of the movie happens. Again, all of this is fine. But it was odd because it's such a major plot point of the film. And it didn't feel, I will say, I thought the Whedon version realized that more than the Snyder version, if that makes sense. I won't necessarily say that it did it better, but I thought that it felt more of an important point in the movie in the Whedon version than it did in this. It felt like just another thing happening in the Snyder version.
Okay, I guess I don't remember it. I don't remember it well, the Whedon version, to disagree with you. So,
to be clear, I not better. Just I thought that the Whedon film was more the crux of that film than it was for the Snyder version. Which is fine. Then maybe you can argue that it wasn't meant to be the crux of the film. But to me, I feel like it should be one of the focal points of the movie. It's kind of one of the points is
bringing Superman back, is that the right choice? What are the, as the Snyder version shows, what are the potential future ramifications of this decision? And it just felt like the whole thing, their like realization that they could do it and them doing it, it felt like it was a very, very quick turnaround.
I do have a question for you, because I don't remember. The Snyder version had Superman in his black costume the whole time. Didn't he, in the Whedon version, didn't he go back to the blue and red?
Yeah, we don't see the black suit at all. And that's one of the things I think they refilmed, was mainly just to have it be the blue suit, which, it fine. If you think that it's better for Superman to look like his classic suit, that's, I get that. But is it worth the CGI lips? And the answer is no. No, it's not. That's the thing that got me, Drew. It's like, I can see the argument. I don't necessarily agree, but I can see the argument for preferring some of the stuff that Whedon does with Superman compared to what Snyder does. Ultimately, I don't think it's that big of a difference. They're about the same. And if they're about the same, it's not worth the monstrosity that we got. Like, that's the cost benefit is just not there.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. All right, anything else you want to say about Snyder's Justice League before we wrap this up?
I'm curious what you think on this, Drew. It felt like the nightmare scene we got in the end credits felt like a pitch to me, to Warner Bros. That was so long, and it was good, so I'm not complaining, but that was too long to have been an after credits thing. That felt a lot like a, hey, I could still make this movie.
Yeah, I thought that was unnecessary to the movie. So I have to agree with you. That did feel like a pitch.
The other thing that this surprised me, and it was better, was the change in the Luther Deathstroke after credit scene. I wasn't expecting that scene to be different, and then it was. I was like, oh, that's, I actually kind of like that. That was cool. Changing it from being, what if we formed a league of our own, to being just a hey, FYI, I've got some juicy info on one of your nemesis here. I like that a lot better. And that seemed to be a much better lead into, it felt like the theatrical one was trying to tease a Justice League movie. And that one felt like that was teasing what was, I'm assuming, meant to be the Ben Affleck Batman film.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. And I did like Snyder's version better, too. And it felt more like what a villain would do, you know, just kind of pass on the information.
Absolutely. Well, and that's the kind of info that would get Deathstroke interested. Deathstroke's not going to be interested in, oh, form a league of our own. Okay, that's not Deathstroke. you can talk some of the other ones into that, but like Gorilla Grodd maybe or something. But you're not. Deathstroke's got better things to do.
Yes, definitely.
My big takeaway from this is, if you have HBO Max, it's worth checking out. Even if you chunk it into chapters, I will say I don't think the chapters are always great breaking points. So I don't know. You might be able to speak better to this. I don't know how well it watches if you stop at the end of a chapter. But certainly that's one way to watch it if you don't want to commit to 4 hours. But it's worth checking out. It is, in my opinion, a clear improvement on Justice League. Now, if you really hated Justice League, or if for whatever baffling reason you like our podcast but you don't really like superhero movies, you're probably still not going to like his version, because it's still at its core, it's still Zack Snyder. Like, there's still stuff there that doesn't need to be there. Like, there's a way too much slow-mo, stuff like that. But if you like superhero movies, if that, you know, that's a genre that you really enjoy, this is a clear improvement. It is a much better version of the Justice League movie.
Shoot, take out all the slow-mo. You could probably save a half hour, 45 minutes.
I mean, even like the football scene, like, come on. I did not need the entire play in slow-mo. Dude, come on.
All right. Well, that wraps up our show for this week. Do you have a shout-out, Cletus?
Yeah, so the favorite comic of mine that we read this week was Swamp Thing, and we were talking about Zack Snyder. So I thought, well, Scott Snyder, had a pretty good run on Swamp Thing, too.
That's a stretch for you. Anyway, yeah. He had a really good run in the start of the New 52 on Swamp Thing, and it's got there's a collected version if you like that sort of thing that's got all 18, 19 issues of his Swamp Thing run. Also, you can, I'm sure, find the trade versions of those or the digital versions of the issues, but it's the initial run of Swamp Thing in the New 52, I think it's 1 through 18, 0 through 18, technically. It's good. I mean, it's Scott Snyder, so, I mean, generally dependable quality, and then it's a pretty good Swamp Thing story.
All right, and for my shout-out, I'm going to shout-out about Sinestro Volume 1, The Demon Within. Cletus shouted out about this a few weeks ago, and I decided to check it out. I'm not all the way through it yet, but I'm through some of it, and it's pretty good so far. And I thought that would be a good shout-out since we were talking about Green Lantern today, and we had Sinestro and his core in it. So
it's a great book. It's the only, I told Drew this, it's the only book that spun out of Johns's run that I felt actually continued that world. Again, that's subjective. That's just my opinion, but that it was the only book that kept going after his run was over that felt like I was still living in that world. What I like is that it's Cullen Bunn's story. Like he's clearly telling his story. He's not trying to do his versions of John's, but it's still within that world. And I really like that.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it so far. So I also suggest you check that out. All right. If you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about this week, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-564-9133. Leave us a message. Or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Batman the Detective number 1, Rorschach number 7, The Joker, Batman Urban Legends, Superman, Wonder Woman, and of course our CW shows. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Time to go.
You sure this is necessary? The Guardians of the Universe seem to think so.
How long will you be gone? But we will be back, little brother.
I wish I could go with.
I doubt your mother would approve.
I'll miss you.
Perhaps you could water the plants in my apartment while I am gone.
Be careful, all right?
May the gods be with you all.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.